Hello there and welcome. Today is Tuesday, May the 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump says he would meet with the elusive leader of North Korea.
We cannot let what's been going on for a long period of years continue.
Thousands turn out to march for a day without immigrants. Is Facebook trying to monitor teenagers' emotional state? Also ahead, DC's film festival shows how politics and social issues are intertwining. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump, after weeks of assailing North Korea's nuclear weapons ambitions, said Monday that he would be, quote, honored to meet with Pyongyang's leader, Kim Jong-un, under the right circumstances to discuss the issue. In an interview with Bloomberg News, Trump declared, if it would be appropriate for me to meet with him, I would absolutely. I would be honored to do it if it's under the right circumstances, but I would do that. Later, however, during his press briefing with White House spokesman Sean Spicer was asked about the comments, said there's no Trump-Kim meeting in the offing and it won't occur unless North Korea ends its provocative behavior in pursuit of nuclear weapons.
This is somebody who has starved his own people, somebody that has threatened to destroy the United States. Just last week he put out a video showing the Capitol getting destroyed by North Korean fighters. How could he be honored to meet with Kim Jong-un?
Well, the president understands the threat that North Korea poses, and he will do whatever is necessary under the right circumstances to protect our country from the threat that they pose.
Well, Kim has not met with a foreign leader since assuming power after his father's death in 2011 and hasn't left his isolated country, not even to visit neighboring China, its prime economic benefactor. North Korea has condemned U.S. military drills in the region as acts of intimidation and blackmail, and has threatened to attack the lead U.S. ship off of its shores. President Trump was asked by CBS's Face the Nation if he thinks Kim is sane.
He was a young man of 26 or 27 when he took over from his father, when his father died. He's dealing with obviously very tough people, in particular the generals and others. And at a very young age, he was able to assume power. A lot of people, I'm sure, tried to take that power away, whether it was his uncle or anybody else. And he was able to do it. So obviously, he's a pretty smart cookie. But we have a situation that we just cannot let. We cannot let what's been going on for a long period of years continue.
North Korea, in violation of UN sanctions, has continued to test ballistic missiles, the latest a failed launch over the past weekend. Pyongyang also has conducted 5 nuclear tests. President Trump declining to say if the U.S. had anything to do with the 2 most recent North Korean missile launch failures. The Korea Economic Institute's Troy Stangerone was asked by VOA's Victor Beatty how much U.S. involvement might there have been.
I think it's something that we have probably been exploring for a while. We saw this same issue, at least with the centrifuges in Iran. That being said, developing dependable missiles is very difficult. It's called rocket science for a reason. We use that phrase. I think it's much more likely that North Korea is experiencing technical difficulties than we are actually sabotaging their missiles.
Mr. Trump referenced Chinese leader Xi Jinping many times, calling him respected, calling him someone who he can work with. Is he relying too much on what China might be able to do to leverage North Korea into halting its nuclear and missile programs?
This has been a difficulty that every administration has faced. In the absence of being willing to take and utilize military force to stop the program, pressuring China to pressure North Korea is one of the few, if perhaps the only, card that we really have. And so taking and trying to take and convince China, perhaps through sweeteners by speaking kindly of China, is perhaps one way to try and induce them to take and apply the pressure that's going to be needed to bring North Korea back to the table.
What do you make of the apparent effort by the Trump administration to assemble an Asia coalition involving countries like Japan, South Korea, the Philippines most recently, Singapore, and Thailand in some sort of grand coalition against North Korea?
This, I think, is really a continuation of something that, to be honest, South Korea under Park Geun-hye took a lead on. If you go back a couple years ago, the Park administration was going to many of the governments that had supported North Korea or had done business with them and asked them to cut off their ties. And so I think we're seeing perhaps in a different guise, but a similar pattern of trying to isolate North Korea by bringing countries together and having them all agree to come to the same page and work together to try and finally resolve this issue.
It seemed to work somewhat with Iran, at least getting an agreement with Tehran over its nuclear program. Will we get the same result with North Korea?
I think that's going to be difficult to say at this point. If you look at Iran, I think one thing we need to keep in mind is that this isn't something that happens quickly. This will take time, especially once we bring them back to the negotiating table. The other thing I think to keep in mind is that in the case of Iran, as much as we may view the regime as authoritarian, which it is, Iran is a much more open society. They have elections there to which, while the Ayatollah has taken and perhaps rolled back in a couple occasions, we've seen street protests. These are the kinds of things that are simply unthinkable in North Korea.
And Stangaron says with the South Korean presidential election looming on May 9th, it could mean another South Korean effort to engage Pyongyang in dialogue as a way to ease tensions. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Last-minute cancellation leaves the Bahamas concertgoer stranded, one dead and several hurt in a University of Texas stabbing. Donald Trump wonders why the U.S. Civil War occurred. And Human Rights Watch says Syria used nerve gas in four recent attacks. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Protesters in the United States and around the world have marked International Workers' Day. May Day is traditionally a day of protest, and this one was no different. In the United States, the rallying point shifted from workers to immigrants. Thousands marked the so-called Day Without Immigrants from New York to Los Angeles with protests against President Trump's focus on boosting deportations. In Washington, about 150 businesses closed, most of them restaurants and legal offices. Other businesses in the city offered a paid day for employees who wanted to demonstrate. Joining me now to talk more about this is Justin Guest, an assistant professor of public policy at George Mason University and author of The New Minority. So tell us a little bit about what exactly was this Day Without Immigrants all about?
You know, this is both substantive, but also, I think, symbolic, Lori. You know, the immigrants and immigrant rights movements are determined to help Americans recognize how integral immigrants are to American society, to their economy, to their politics, to their history, and coming out in droves and having that visual, vivid representation of their power, but also their investment in the American future is a really powerful thing to have. That said, this is a group of people that is also very vulnerable. This is a group of people subject to changes in American laws and regulation and governance. And they have been made to feel vilified and also very vulnerable by the current administration. And so this is also a rallying cry, a sort of opportunity to show solidarity with this group of people as well. And I think it's also a part of the therapy for them to come together and feel more powerful against some of the more draconian aspects of the Trump administration's policies.
What do you think their very specific message was regarding those policies?
We are here and we are not going anywhere.
That is the message of the immigrants, whether they are documented or undocumented.
That's right. It's about presence. It's about presence. It's about role in the American economy and its politics and its future. It is about demonstrating their care and their interest in American society, and the fact that they are going to be persistent and vigilant about the policies and actions by the Trump administration.
What kind of change do you think that they're hoping events like this, marches like this, will bring about?
It's a multi-layered appeal because there are a variety of interest groups that immigrants and their advocacy groups want to reach. The most general mass level. It's about changing minds about who immigrants are and what their role is in American society and how important they are, and that these are not just immigrants. These are not just a pair of hands that pick fruit or wash cars or clean office buildings. This is a group of innovators, of political capital, a group that actually is invested in the society, that changes it culturally and creates and innovates and creates new ideas. It is what makes America the dynamic place that it has always been. And so it is to remind people that these are their neighbors. These are their coworkers. These are their colleagues. And so that's the first level. At the next level up, they want to reach politicians by reminding them that this is a very mobilized group of people that is angry and that has a lot of voting power behind them, as we saw in earlier elections and as we saw in this election as well. Just because Hillary Clinton and the Democrats lost this election does not mean that there was not a significant turnout amongst people of immigrant origin and people who are in solidarity with immigrants. And then finally, it's about making the Trump administration think twice about what it does. Inevitably, the choices of the Trump administration to suspend the refugee program, to enact more draconian enforcement procedures against the undocumented, to restrict visa admissions, these actions please a lot of his supporters in a very diffuse way, but they have a concentrated effect on immigrants themselves, their friends, their families, and their allies, and also their business owners. And if you piss off that group of people with these concentrated impacts, they are likely to be very mobilized against you in the future.
That's Justin Guest, assistant professor of public policy at George Mason University and author of The New Minority. Thanks for being with us. Well, the People's Climate March happened over the weekend, and that drew over 200,000 people to Washington, D.C., and more at other marches across the country and globally. Joining me for that is Jeffrey Graser, an environmental attorney with the New York firm Sive, Paget, and Rizel, who came to D.C. with a busload of people. So folks seem to be pretty fired up about the environmental stuff.
People are very focused not just on marching, but on pressing for solutions to climate change. And the fact is that there are many solutions at hand that simply need to be implemented. I think it was important for people to be in Washington to make that point. But a lot of what's happening in the climate change realm right now is happening outside of Washington, and there's a recognition that these protest marches, while important, are probably not going to influence the president or this Congress, but will send the message that there are people out, many, many people out there in all walks of life, who want solutions to climate change and not continued denial.
Well, the administration is overhauling the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency's website, to what it says reflect its new policies. What do we know about what they're doing?
Well, I think all we know at the moment is that they're removing references to climate change subject to some future review. But to me, it's reminiscent of you know, book burnings or burning ancient libraries. I mean, this is science. If they want to put up other information that's been peer-reviewed that contradicts what the thousands of peer-reviewed scientists have already concluded, that's one thing. I don't think that eliminating the words from a website is going to accomplish much.
Well, the march also coincided with President Trump's 100th day in office. He does seem very focused on climate issues and reversing his predecessor's policies. He says it's to create jobs. Do you believe that he's on the right track with that?
No. If he wants to create jobs, he should be promoting renewable energy jobs, which are the fastest growing sector of jobs in the energy space. That would create a lot of good local jobs, including in coal country. Recently, a coal mining company announced a very, very large solar project on one of their sites. That's what he should be promoting right now.
Also, some other environmental issues that came up with this administration on Friday, last Friday, president signed an executive order to allow offshore drilling in what is currently protected areas of the Arctic and Atlantic Oceans. So that was quite a big deal for environmentalists.
I think it'll be interesting to see whether the economics support that kind of activity. There is a growing recognition that conventional drilling on land and not in sensitive water environments is more profitable. It remains to be seen, first of all, whether these executive orders will be challenged or whether subsequent regulatory efforts will be challenged in the courts. I expect they will. But I also question whether the economics of conducting activities in those areas will lead to significant levels of activity. I think in terms of the Atlantic, most people would rather see wind projects than oil drilling.
You mentioned the Court of Appeals, which Friday issued a ruling that would appear to make it easier for the president to scrap President Obama's Clean Power Plan. Where does that stand?
Well, that decision really related to a narrow question of whether the rule should be remanded to the EPA for further consideration. So it doesn't in and of itself make it easier. In addition, EPA has already found that greenhouse gases endanger public health and the environment, and under a Supreme Court decision, once it's done that, it's legally obligated to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. So this is far from over in terms of how the ultimate rulemaking proceeding will go and subsequent litigation.
And for folks out there that are concerned about the threat of climate change and the future and want to address the impacts, what can you tell people to give them some hope despite the current administration's policies when it comes to environmental and climate issues?
I think there's a lot of reason for hope. And there's a recent book by Mayor Bloomberg called Climate of Hope, which is a good read, which talks about how states and cities and business will be leading the effort to address climate change, notwithstanding the absence of leadership in Washington. Recently, 16 Fortune 500 companies sent a letter to the president asking that we remain in the Paris Agreement. That's 16 companies with a combined market capitalization of $3.4 trillion. So business understands that this issue has to be addressed. In addition to that, I think we're beginning to see newly minted activism, not only in environmental groups, but in the corporate sector. There are a lot of people within corporations who want to see action on climate, and those people are a very powerful force, and every citizen in America who has a job can talk about this issue within their companies, and there's a growing recognition that that kind of grassroots activism in the private sector, not just with environmental groups, but from people in the business community, is a force that will have to be reckoned with.
All right. We appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. Jeffrey Gracer, environmental attorney with the New York firm Sive, Paget, and Rizel. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
I'm Victor Beatty. Since 1942, the Voice of America has been a consistently reliable and authoritative source of news. Today, VOA remains committed to providing an accurate, objective, and comprehensive news product at the top of every hour, every day. We can be heard on your local affiliate or streamed on the web at voanews.com.
Jazz America!
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, we turn now to what's been trending on social media, and for that, we're joined by Andrew Palchewski. Hey, Andrew, what's happening?
Well, a troubling report from the Australian newspaper that Facebook is apparently trying to monitor teenagers' emotional states.
Whoa.
Yes, so they're trying to use social media content to figure out when teens are feeling things like stress, deflated, anxious, useless, and a failure. It's not clear exactly why they're trying to monitor this, and the Australian newspaper and others have speculated that it's to maybe market products to teens that'll make them feel better. One instance that they mention is weight loss, trying to determine when teens are maybe insecure about their weight and then market weight loss products to them. But this is getting a lot of attention, a lot of negative attention towards Facebook. Now, Facebook has come out and put out a statement where they say the premise of this article in The Australian is misleading. Facebook, they say, does not offer tools to target people based on their emotional state. What they say this was an analysis by an Australian researcher intending to help marketers understand how people express themselves on Facebook. And some people defending Facebook have said, well, maybe they're trying to identify these instances where teens are feeling defeated or useless or a failure. It might be something like suicide prevention or trying to identify bullying. Those are big issues that Facebook has had to deal with on their social network. So Facebook goes on and says it was never used to target ads and was based on data that was anonymous and aggregated. That was the other concern, is how are they getting this data? Whose profiles are they looking at?
Yeah, that's worrisome.
Yeah, so Facebook is defending this. I don't think this is the last we're going to hear about this. I think that this is something that we've seen from social networks in the past, that they've tried to use different data points to target people, to sell them things or to identify different aspects. So I think this is just the tip of the iceberg, as we say, on what Facebook is doing behind the scenes.
I know you will keep us posted. Anything else going on?
Yes. So President Trump recently celebrated his first 100 days in office, despite his saying that it was a milestone or not a milestone that he was going to mark in particular. He thought it was a false milestone. But there's been a lot of analysis about his presidency thus far, including his tweeting. Now, this comes from a digital firm aptly named Huge. Of course, that's one of the phrases that President Trump likes to use. He calls everything huge. And they found, actually, that over the first 100 days in office, his Twitter likes, responses, and retweets have declined by about two-thirds.
Really?
So
interesting.
The first 100 days have shown that he's decreasing engagement.
Huh. Interesting.
Now, part of this, they say, is because his tweets are not as angry, I guess, or aggressive, and those tweets tend to get more engagement. So they've kind of tempered, and as a result, maybe getting less engagement. They say it may also be that people are not replying as much because a lot of those replies come from people who are opposed to his positions, and there may be kind of a fatigue, a protest fatigue.
Right.
But there's a lot of analysis and speculation about what this means. If Twitter is going to continue to be the medium that he's going to use, if he's not getting as much engagement, if he might turn angrier to get more engagement, or he might change his tone to try to get more people to click on his tweets and to engage with him. So we'll have to see if that sparks a change in his strategy, if the decline continues, or if it changes. Who knows?
All right. Thanks so much, Andrew. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, for over 30 years, FilmFest DC has been bringing thought-provoking movies from all over the world to discerning audience in the U.S. capital, promoting discussion and debate. This spring, the festival is celebrating its 31st anniversary with 80 selected films. VOA's Penelope Pulu has more.
Washington, D.C., where politics and culture intertwine. So, it is no surprise to find films with social and political messages from all over the world in the city's film festival. Tony Giddens, founder and head of the Washington, D.C. International Film Festival, came to VOA to talk about this year's offerings.
These are films that look at the issues that have been heightened with the new presidential administration. So, for example, we're looking at immigration. We're looking at the importance of public education versus charter school or commercializing education. We're looking at the need for free press.
Among the films Giddens has selected is All Governments Lie from Canadian filmmaker Fred Peabody. It traces the history of free, independent journalism and its significance to the pursuit of truth and preservation of democracy.
There's only two types of reporters. There's those who care and those who don't. Most of them don't care.
Another noteworthy film is the documentary The Good Postman by Bulgarian filmmaker Tonislav Hristov.
It looks at people who live in a small town and have to decide. I mean, Syrians are coming into their community. How do they adjust to it? Is it going to help their economy or is it going to hurt them in some way? And so these are issues that are faced by Europeans and Americans from day to day.
The festival offers a variety of films looking at social and cultural displacement from the perspective of ethnic communities existing as insular islands in other cultures. One example is A Wedding, a feature drama by Stefan Strecker. This French-Pakistani production deals with the values of a Pakistani family living in France and ends in tragedy when one of the daughters chooses a new way of life over tradition.
Bah ouais, je résiste.
One of the most visually impressive films this year is Human. Photographer and filmmaker Jan Arthus Bertrand delivers breathtaking cinematography about humanity, weaving a picture of vast landscapes, the world as seen from up high, with mankind dwarfed in it. The filmmaker interviews people from all walks of life.
It's about the world, the whole planet, environment, and as well as people's social needs, their economic needs and interests, how in a way we're different, but in fundamental ways we're very similar.
Gittens says it is not always easy to select films for intellectually demanding and politically savvy Washingtonians, but he says his year-long quest for the best selections are always appreciated. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Charles Hall. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In response to the chemical weapons attack April 4th that killed approximately 100 civilians in the town of Khan Shaykhun, Syria, the U.S. Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control, or OFAC, has announced sanctions against 271 employees of the Syrian government agency responsible for developing such weapons and the means to deliver them. The 271 designated individuals from Syria's Scientific Studies and Research Center have expertise in chemistry or have worked in support of the center's chemical weapons program since at least 2012. As a result of their designation, any assets these people hold in the United States are frozen, and U.S. persons and businesses are generally prohibited from conducting business with them. The U.S. move comes just weeks after the regime of Bashar al-Assad dropped chemical weapons from the sky on Khan Shaykhun, resulting in an agonizing death for the villagers below. And it follows the United States' targeted military response 2 days later of launching 59 missiles onto the airfield from which Assad's chemical weapons attack originated. At a press briefing at the White House, U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said the action against the staff of Syria's Scientific Studies and Research Center is one of the largest ever executed by OFAC.
In a single action, we are more than doubling the number of individuals and entities sanctioned since the start of the Syrian conflict pursuant to Syria-related executive orders. These sweeping sanctions are intended to hold the Assad regime and those who support it directly or indirectly accountable for their blatant violations of the Chemical Weapons Convention in UN Security Council Resolution 2118.
The United States is sending a strong message that we will not tolerate the use of chemical weapons by any actor, and we intend to hold the Assad regime accountable for its unacceptable behavior, Mr. Mnuchin said. The Treasury Department, together with the Department of State and our international partners, will continue to relentlessly pursue and shut down the financial networks of any individuals involved with serious production and use of chemical weapons.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.